tonight on Arena. Michael Crummy, the winner of this year's Dublin Literary Award, and Mission Impossible: The Final Reckoning, The Phoenician Scheme and The Flats are the movies up for review. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can watch us on rte.ie/arena. Two movie reviews first on this Thursday evening. It's the final outing for Tom Cruise's Ethan Hunt in Mission Impossible: The Final Reckoning. Ethan and the team continue their search for the terrifying AI entity known as the Entity. Well done, Sean. Which has infiltrated intelligence networks and presenters' mouths all over the globe, with the governments and a mysterious ghost from Ethan's past on their trail. The Phoenician Scheme is the latest offering from Wes Anderson. It stars Benicio del Toro as Zaza Corder, a wealthy businessman who appoints his only daughter, a nun, played by Mia Threapleton, as sole heir to his estate. And finally, The Flats, a documentary from Alessandra Celesia, which follows Joe, a man from Belfast, and he, along with his neighbours, reenact childhood memories from the violent Troubles era in their Catholic New Lodge area. Joined in studio this evening by Joe Griffin and Dee Malumbi, and we'll start with the big one, Mission Impossible: The Final Reckoning. I don't know whether I ever believe them when they say it's the final one, but this has the sense of it. And they spend a long time here, Joe, setting everything up and telling us stuff from other movies that I wonder, do we need to know?
Yeah, that was probably the biggest problem I had with this film. I'm a big fan of the franchise, but one thing I really like about these films is, and something it has in common with the James Bond films, which is an influence, is that they're mostly standalone little 2-hour capsules of entertainment, whereas this one, as you mentioned, keeps harkening back. It's got a kind of a victory lap quality as it keeps acknowledging, referring to things that happened. So the first hour of this almost 3-hour film is kind of a thicket of exposition and very well-known character actors shouting exposition at one another in beautiful rooms. And it really kicks in the rest of it, in the other half.
Well, guess what? The clip we have is a bit of exposition looking back at what has happened. And yes, you have very well-known character actors here, not quite shouting at each other, but kind of bemused at what has happened in the past and can it be recurring once more?
This can't all be true.
Every word. The CIA Black Vault break-in.
Am I reading this correctly? The Kremlin bombing?
In fairness, the bomb was actually meant to kill him.
He gassed a security briefing at the National Intelligence Directorate.
That was just 2 months ago. You two would have been in that meeting.
He arrived in the form of Mr. Kittredge's aide.
And left as Mr. Kittredge, I believe.
It's all very serious and ominous, but it does get going and there are great action sequences. And Dee, you have to say, it's very hard not to just admire, if not downright like, Tom Cruise. He's doing all these stunts as usual himself, hanging off the edge of aeroplanes, you know, all the usual kind of stuff. And it is eminently watchable in that respect.
Yeah, and I mean, you have to appreciate Tom Cruise's commitment and sheer insanity in the physical feats that he's taken on across this franchise. And all just for the sake of our entertainment. He's not doing it for the awards, lads. He's just doing it so that we
there
enjoy ourselves.
There may be some money involved as well.
There may
I would
be
have
money
thought.
As well. Yeah, yeah. Admittedly, it might be also the money thing. But yeah, I mean, like, look, you can't deny that Ethan Hunt is, you know, an absolutely iconic character that Tom Cruise has given us. And it's funny, we were kind of chatting there about, like, the amazing cast that you have here. You have the likes of Hayley Atwell, Ving Rhames, Simon Pegg, Isai Morales, and more returning, as well as new faces like Holt McElhaney, Janik McTeer, Nick Offerman, Hannah Waddingham. Him. But I was watching this film thinking, we have some great cast members here. We don't learn about any of these characters. This is the Tom Cruise show. And in fact, there's a fair portion of the movie where it's literally just Tom Cruise on the screen, no one else. And you don't really mind because that is what this franchise is all about. It's Ethan Hunt.
Yeah, but this AI, the entity, it kind of looks like it's a shift more in a sci-fi type of direction. I mean, surely this just should be, you know, nasty spies doing, having all kinds of secret guns and equipment to kill people. But AI, do we want an AI involved in things like this?
Well, yeah, I personally prefer spy movies when they're just stealing identities and selling them, or like stealing a warhead and selling it or something like that, which is what most of the previous ones are like. And the AI thing is both topical and a little off track, I think. So yeah, AI is on everybody's lips at the moment, but at the same time, like, it can't count how many oars are in Strawberry, which is something I read recently. So there's a lot of limitations to AI. So it's a bit of a stretch to ask that an AI can take over all 7 nuclear arsenals in the world and pit the entire world against each other.
I think if you were looking for gritty reality, possibly Mission Impossible is not the place to go. The action sequences themselves, is there enough of them and are they satisfying enough for you, Dee?
I will give it that. I mean, the first hour, like Joe was saying there, I mean, there were so many montages. It was getting ridiculous, and plot tie-ins to previous Mission Impossible movies. But once it actually gets into the action, there are two fantastic, extensive, impressive action set pieces here. One of them of which involves this kind of deep water exploration and submarine mission. I couldn't help but it recalled to mind something that like James Cameron would have done with like The Abyss, and what he probably wanted to achieve with Avatar The Way of Water but fell short there. And then there's another kind of final action sequence which involves like two biplanes, and you know that Tom Cruise is actually like flying up in the air doing all of these like crazy like climbs around it, holding on by just a seatbelt at one point. Like, it is absolutely thrilling. You have to give it that. At the same time, I was watching this film thinking, it is kind of the same stuff again. Like, we've seen Tom Cruise go underwater. I can't even remember which Mission Impossible it was, but he like held some record for like holding his breath or whatever. And even the biplane sequence in this, it did recall like the whole sequence with Helicopter and Henry Cavill from Fallout. So it's starting to get a little staged.
Ripper. Well, maybe The Final Reckoning isn't a bad idea in that respect. Standout, obviously, Cruise is, it, as Dee said, it's kind of the Tom Cruise show at times here. But any other performances that stood out for you, Joe? And stars, please.
Yeah, I really like Tramiel Tilman as a kind of a kooky submarine commander. People would know him from Severance. Tom Cruise is the Jackie Chan of the West. He really brings it. 3.5 for me.
3.5. And what are you saying, Dee?
Yeah, 3 stars for me. Like, it's fine, but yeah, definitely the franchise is getting a bit old. We've seen enough impossible missions at
right,
this point.
So you both want it to be The Final Reckoning, and Tom can go off and do something now that doesn't involve doing lots of stunts. Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning, 3 and 3.5 stars respectively for that. Let's move on then to the Phoenician Scheme. It's only 2 years, I can't believe it, since Wes Anderson's Asteroid City was in Irish cinemas, and 1 year since Netflix launched his Roald Dahl anthology called The Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar. But here we are with a new film, The Phoenician Scheme from Anderson. The premise actually here is straightforward enough, I think it's safe to say, Joe.
For a Wes Anderson film, there's a lot of moving parts usually in his films. So this is about an extremely rich man who's fabulously named Zsa Zsa Korda, played by Benicio del Toro. He's a kind of a swindling rogue who has this incredibly elaborate plan that he wants to set into motion. That's the title of the film, where he wants to go around the world and create a dam, build a tunnel, bring infrastructure to a fictitious country. He's short of money, so he has to go hat in hand to negotiate with all of the people that he's made the initial deals with. And he's bringing his daughter in tow, played by Kate Winslet's daughter, Mia Tripleton, who looks and
speaks. Called Mia Tripleton forever. I mean, she's very happy to be Kate Winslet's daughter, but we should give her space here.
In fairness, she gives a good performance. In fact, I'm very respectful of Nepo babies who don't use their parents' famous name.
Nepo babies who aren't Nepo babies.
Yes. like Nicolas Cage is not Nicolas Coppola's real name. So fair play to her. So it's a nice performance by her. So what we're watching is the kind of evolution of this roguish businessman who might find his conscience along the way and the business deals he's trying to sew up.
Yeah, but however, it would seem as if even getting into a car, getting into an aeroplane as well, as we will hear, all of them are very dangerous activities for the Del Toro character.
At this moment, Rescue workers are laboring to recover and identify the remains of Zsa Zsa Korda. International businessman, maverick in the fields of armaments and aviation, among the richest men in Europe. This was Korda's sixth recorded airplane crash. He is survived by 10 children, 9 boys, 1 nun, his daughter Liesel.
I've appointed you sole heir to my estate, which you may come into sooner rather than later.
Why? It's been 6 years since our last meeting.
I have my reasons.
Which are what?
My reasons? I'm not saying. I'm not saying.
Very Wes Anderson, that last line. Benicio del Toro there as Zsa Zsa Korda and Mia Threapleton as Sir Liesel, his daughter, the nun, who's going to inherit everything ahead of the 9 boys in this particular case. And even in that, apart from the news report and the very dramatic music underneath it, so much of what I saw in trailers and bits online on this one, Dee, it's the deadpan delivery. It's classic Wes Anderson in that respect. It's either deadpan or absolutely hysterical.
Yeah.
High energy hysteria is one or the other.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, this film does have like Wes Anderson oeuvre all over it. You've got your whimsical style of storytelling. Like, whimsy is always the first word that comes to mind when I think of Wes Anderson. That kind of stylistic square framing where there's kind of a lot going on and it's all like quite square. Those moments of kind of dry humor, a bit of like romance sprinkled in, but a very Wes Anderson type of like weird romance almost, with kind of quirky individuals, and that zippy style of editing. It's an interesting one. Like, I would say it's like a very charming, a very worthy entry into his filmography. Is there enough kind of distinct in it to make it anyone's favourite? Maybe not necessarily, but it's still a very enjoyable movie. Mm. At that, if you don't like the director's work, stay well away from it, because it is very much
of his style. And typical of Wes Anderson is the design and the look of the thing. Is this in a similar type of high concept design world, Joe?
Yeah, like whatever you might think of Wes Anderson, his films always look beautiful, beautifully framed. You'd nearly hang any of the scenes on your wall of your house. Lovely use of primary colours, retro devices. There's every now and again I got distracted by beautiful old school devices, like when he got his stocks from the ticker machine that rattled out the stocks on a long strip of paper, and like the old school cameras and everything. Really exquisite looking. Whether that's enough to make up for the film being quite slight and quite...
In terms of plot and character, is it slight?
Yeah, I would say so in terms of character. His films have become, in my opinion, the more stylized his work has become over the years, the less emotionally rich they become. So Rushmore and The Royal Tenenbaums are really emotionally rich. And then they got more arch... film by film over the years.
I mean, we were talking about the cast in Mission Impossible. Scarlett Johansson, Bill Murray, Michael Cera, Tom Hanks, Benedict Cumberbatch, Jeffrey Wright, Bryan Cranston. I stopped writing at that point. I mean, it is really star-studded. Are they all just little cameos? Oh, well, Michael Cera is a fairly important character.
Yeah, Michael Cera would probably have third billing here. He plays basically a newly hired private tutor for the wily adopted sons, who are very much mischief makers here. But yeah, I would say you've kind of got your three leads, and really the other roles are cameos. At that, there are some like standout performances. Benedict Cumberbatch's role as Uncle Nubar comes very late in the film, but I thought he was very good. I really enjoyed Tom Hanks and Bryan Cranston's turn as a pair of aggravated Americans left short on a deal who decide to turn to a game of basketball to have it out. So there are like little scenes like that that are quite nice. But yeah, really the film is led, I would say, by Benicio Del Toro and Mia Threapleton's performances, and they're both very good. I thought Benicio Del Toro as Zsa, he kind of brings this like slight menace that I think that actor has always been synonymous with, but he's also like full of bravado and almost like a George Clooney-esque cheekiness, which was reminiscent of, I thought, like Fantastic Mr. Fox or something like that.
So overall, did this work for you, Joe? What would you say of the Phoenician Scheme from Wes Anderson?
I had mixed feelings. I would give it a 3.
Yeah, and for you, Dee?
I would give it 3.5. I thought it was a pleasant enough feature that doesn't overstay its welcome, and yeah, very enjoyable.
A pleasant enough feature that doesn't overstay its welcome. I don't see that on the poster, but 3, kind of solid scoring for both of you on that one. Let's move on finally then to The Flats, a documentary about the rundown New Lodge estate in Belfast. It looks at the families who still live with the unresolved agony of the Troubles a quarter of a century on. the first thing that strikes me about this documentary is that to get these people from the New Lodge flats to actually sit down and to relive as they do, they kind of reenact many of the memories and many of the events from the past. To persuade them to do that must have taken a big job. Some persuading, I would have thought, Joe.
Yeah, it must have. Although for some, they might have considered it cathartic or therapeutic. And it's not the first time documentarians have asked the subjects to recreate. There's a film called The Look of Silence, which does a lot of the same thing by Joshua Oppenheimer. So even asking somebody to open up and converse about seismic experiences in their lives is difficult, especially for some of the people in this film. And some of them admit that they never got past something that happened when they were as young as nine.
Something awful happening in your life at that age, it would be incredibly difficult to deal with.
Yeah. Even 50 years later, they still can't. And it's a really stark reminder that in places where ceasefires have been signed and the media circus and the politicians have moved on, they're still walking wounded, but physically and psychologically living where it is.
The main character that brings us through a lot of this is a man called Joe. What kind of man is he, and who else do we meet in the documentary, Dee?
Yeah, so Joe McNally is a really quite interesting character, and I was particularly struck by the scenes in which he's kind of attending this counselling. He expresses a lot of emotion in those scenes, a lot of vulnerability, which I still think you don't really typically see in depictions of men on like the big screen necessarily. And, you know, for a documentary, for him to be this kind of open and vulnerable, for example, talking about his memories of his 17-year-old cousin and being kind of in the bathtub and his cousin passing him a couple of coins into him, like that, and that gorgeous relationship, and his cousin ended up dying, and that's something that still kind of haunts him to this day. So there's some really gorgeous scenes like that. And for me, a couple of the other standouts were Jolene and Angie, who are these two women. Angie is actually a bit kind of older than Jolene, but they share this great chemistry and some really like quite funny scenes together. But then sometimes they turn like quite dark as well. There's one sequence particularly involving bringing a tanning bed into the apartment block, which I thought ended up taking some really quite interesting turns.
Yeah,
you know?
And they talk over each other. Mm-hmm. They have very strong Belfast accents.
Yes.
And you either like the Belfast accent and the Belfast sense of humour, or you don't. I would think, as you'll get a sense of when you listen to this clip, Joe and the neighbours in the flats in New Lodge in Belfast, and they're talking about the thorny subject of am I British or am I Irish. It all starts off with a song. I think it's Joe who's singing, and then they start to chat after that in some strong language toward the end of this.
Oh, Father, why are you so sad on this bright Easter morn when Irishmen are proud and glad of a land where they were born?
So what are we then? Nothing.
How are we Irish if we have a British passport?
But you can be British or Irish.
We're not allowed
any.
Irish.
I don't know why I'm British or Irish. Now you tell me I'm Irish.
Fully Irish. You were born on this island, the island of Ireland.
I threw my first fucking petrol phone when I was 9 and a half. 9 and a fucking half.
That's the voice of Joe McNally there at the end of that clip from the Flats documentary about the New Lodge area in Belfast. Do we get any sense of the new generation of people living in and around the New Lodge area, Joe?
Yeah, even in that conversation there, it offers there are scenes that offer glimmers of hope, I think, when there's a scene where God Save the Queen came on the TV and two of the older people who were in the room covered their ears and turned away from the TV, and the younger woman said, it's just a song. So there's baggage that comes with certain moments for older generations are just are not there, like, for the younger generation. So that gives a glimmer of hope. And there's, while it's not that easy to watch, there's like sprinklings and glimmers of hope throughout the film like that.
And there is an experimental feel to this. Just, you might explain how that manifests itself. And I think one of the ways it does it, Dee, is this then and now, that the kind of the line between the past and the present is kind of hard to, it's not defined at times. And it's a decision not to define it, I think.
Absolutely. And I'm kind of glad I went into this film knowing that the whole idea of it is that the people who live in this tower block apartment in New Lodge, they're kind of reenacting these memories from the Troubles. They're revisiting them and kind of considering how, you know, that period really shaped their lives and kind of shaped the area that they lived in. I found it a bit confusing sometimes. For example, there's a little boy who pops up in the movie who I initially thought was like meant to be kind of a figure in flashbacks. But then in a later scene, he actually goes over to visit Joe to kind of watch a bonfire from his flat. So everyone who's in the movie actually kind of lives in or around that area. And they are kind of like recreating these scenes as a kind of like, you know, working through a type of process. Yeah. And that whole theme of then and now as kind of continuously blurring is really quite interesting, because, for example, you see like news broadcasts looking at the death of Bobby Sands and the riots that followed. And then in the next scene, they're actually talking about them. And even there are moments where like the news broadcasts are kind of superimposed over an image of like Joe himself or the people who live in the apartment themselves. So I thought that was quite interesting. And even that theme of, you know, as we kind of touched on, the young and the old, and the idea that, you know, it's really important for the older people to pass those stories down to the young people. And you see that with Joe and the boy, but you also see that with Angie and Jolene, which I thought was quite interesting.
Okay, yeah. Stars from you on this one, Dee?
I would give it 3 stars. I thought that there was a lot of anger, a lot of grief fueling the movie. It can be quite an intense watch, but I would say it's a very worthwhile one.
Yeah, intense. I think you both had that feeling of it, Joe. Is it a harrowing watch as well? Is that part of the intensity of it?
It's challenging, yeah, but I think it's really rich and substantial as well. It'll be a 4 for me.
A solid 4 from Joe for The Flats, the documentary. And before that, the two big ones that we were speaking about, The Phoenician Scheme and Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning. Dee Mullumby and Joe Griffin, our reviewers on this Thursday evening. You're listening to Thursday Night's Arena. The winner of the Dublin Literary Award was announced earlier today at the International Literature Festival in Dublin. As you know, the prize is one of the most significant and lucrative in the world, with a prize of €100,000 for a single work of fiction. Adding to the prestige of this award, which is sponsored by Dublin City Council, is the fact that every year, the long list of nominated books is created from public libraries in cities around the globe. This year, the winner of the Dublin Literary Award is the Canadian novelist Michael Crummy for his book The Adversary. The novel is set in a 19th century Newfoundland fishing community where the deep animosity between two rival merchants and siblings threatens to destroy the lives and livelihoods of the many people depending on them in this precarious world. Delighted to be joined in studio by Michael Crummy, winner of the Dublin Literary Award. It must be nice to hear that little addendum, Michael.
Not something I ever expected to have attached to my name, but yeah, it's such an honour, and I'm so, so grateful to be here for it.
There are so many great things about this prize, but I think for many authors, the fact that libraries are involved in that long listing is hugely important, because this is about readers.
It is, yeah. And I was nominated by the Newfoundland and Labrador Public Library System. And that system, I can't blame them for everything, but it had a huge influence on me growing up. Like, I grew up in a small mining town, and books were at the library. That's where you found them. And I spent hours as a kid browsing in there and reading. And I wouldn't be who I am today without that.
Who were you reading?
Do you remember?
A lot everything of it, and everybody, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I was very young when I was doing that, so I was reading a lot of things like Tintin and Asterix, like those comics, and then adventure stories for boys, stories about wolves, like the kinds of things that a kid would be interested in. But it created a love of reading in me and a sense of what the written story can do, the places it can take you. And that's never left me.
And I believe your dad, your father, was a great storyteller.
Yeah, I always say I'm the second best storyteller in my family, at best. Newfoundland, when dad was born in 1930, and he started fishing with his father when he was 9. And it was a world that was primarily an oral culture at that time. And people lived in small, isolated communities, so you had to make your own fun. And also, telling stories was a way to record the history of the people that you knew and the places you'd been. So Dad, he had a repertoire, and you could request particular stories, like, tell me the one about your French book. And he had figured out how narrative worked. Like, they weren't told word for word every time, but they had the same beginning, the same middle, same end. And he had this really striking, it was often funny, and then this striking dark turn at the end, which I think had a huge influence on me and how I try to tell stories.
Well, as we say here, it wasn't off the ground, you picked it up.
No, that's right.
And I'm sure you would hear some of that kind of phrase and turn of phrase in Newfoundland, and I was terribly aware, as I said, Canadian. Would you have wanted me to say Newfoundlander, in fact, instead of Canadian?
Well, there is, Newfoundland was the last province to join Canada. Newfoundland was a sort of independent country up until 1949, and always saw itself as separate from the rest of Canada. I think there's a famous song in Newfoundland when the Confederation debates were on. It's a "Come near at your peril, Canadian wolf." And there were the vote in favor of it was razor thin. It was 50.1 to 49.9 or something like that. And up until very recently, there were still people, I think, who never accepted that Newfoundland was a part of Canada. And that's not the same now, but there's still a very distinct sense of who we are.
Maybe it's Canada in general that's worrying about being part of something else now.
I think we have some experience to impart to the rest of our countrymen about what it's like to be imperiled in your sovereignty. Yeah,
we might come back to that, but I do want to talk about the book. Because you describe your father's life and this oral storytelling and the fact that he was a fisherman and his dad was a fisherman before him. The story that you're telling is about a fishing village. An isolated fishing village, a fictional one, but it has the feeling of history and of oral history from it. As I read it, I thought, this is a true story.
Right. Well, it's, I hope it's not true because...
Well, there are sections when I hoped it wasn't true too.
Yeah. It's interesting. Like, I've always said that part of what I've wanted to do as a writer is to put Newfoundland on paper. To try to get some of that old world down on paper before it disappears completely. But this book and the one previous to it, a book called The Innocents, and The Adversary is not a sequel, but it's a companion book to that book. And in a way, they're not about Newfoundland in the same way that the other books are. They take place there because that's what I know. But The Innocents was a book about childhood, and it was based on a story I found in the archives from way back about an orphan brother and sister who they were happened upon by a traveling clergyman. So it was so far back that most communities were too small for churches, and the clergy traveled. And he realized very quickly that the sister was pregnant and assumed, quite rightly, I think, that the brother was the father. And it was just a one-paragraph thing. There was no other information about those children.
And that was a true story.
And my first thought was, oh, that's a story. And my second thought was, I'm not touching that with a 10-foot pole. Because there's so many ways for that to go wrong.
Yeah.
But they haunted me. So I ended up writing that story. And it's kind of a twisted Adam and Eve story. And because it was called The Innocents, I started thinking a lot about Blake's Songs of Innocence and Songs of Experience and the way that he turns the first lyric sequence on its head to tell it from said that it was an attempt to show the two contrary natures of the human soul. And the driving engine of The Innocents is love. Like that brother and sister, what
two
allows
young,
them
and
to
they're
survive.
They're young.
They're very young, and sister, yeah. And go through the change through adolescence towards adulthood in the course of the book. But even when things are difficult, even when they don't like each other, it's their love for each other that allows them to survive. Well, and I wondered, Could I turn that on its head? Could I tell the story from a completely different perspective?
So we have, in this case, again, and I was worried when I was, can we talk about the fact that they're siblings? But we have to talk about the fact that they're siblings. The two lead characters here are brother and sister.
That's right.
It takes us a while to find that out. And if hate is the other side, the mirror image of love, by God, do they have hatred for each other.
And so instead of an Adam and Eve story, this book is a Cain and Abel story.
Mm.
I know it's set a couple of hundred years ago in an isolated Newfoundland fishing village, but in many ways I felt like I was writing out of the world that we have all been living in for the last 10 years or so. It was my response to that world. It was my attempt to say, well, what happens if the worst of who we are as human beings ends up in positions of power?
And I suppose the interesting, you might explain what the truck system was in terms of fishing villages and or outports as they are and were called.
Yep.
What that system was and how the merchants were the people with
all the power.
Absolute power.
Yeah. So Newfoundland up until very recently, up until the 30s, 40s, into the 50s in some ways, operated under the truck system. And that was... fishermen were independent, but they relied on the merchant in their community for absolutely everything. So the merchant would float them supplies, food, whatever they needed on credit. And in return, they had to sell their fish to the merchant at the end of the season. And the complicating factor was that the merchants set the price for what they gave to the fishermen, mm-hmm. and they also set the price for the fish that came in. So most Newfoundland fishermen never saw a copper in cash money. And a lot of them would live most of their lives in debt as well to the merchant. So they were tied to that merchant.
I guess the merchant within the village as well would own every merch, every store, every piece of merchandise came from the merchant.
There was only one store, usually.
Yeah.
Or if there were two, it was because there were two merchants who were competing against each other. And what
book.
We have in this book is that. So the reason I saw that as a way of talking about the world we live in is because it does feel like we are moving into a situation where the locus of power is more and more centralized in the hands of individuals.
Yeah.
And individuals who are, it seems to me, narcissistic sociopaths.
Who could you be talking about?
Well, unfortunately, there are many. Abe Strapp, the brother.
Yeah.
Most people look at him and think I'm just a modeling Donald Trump. In actual fact, he's based on a merchant from the 17th century who, a man named George Ryder. He was a braggart and a bully and a drunkard. He shot and killed an Irish servant in an argument. His punishment for murdering that man was he was made justice of the peace in Bonavista.
Mm-hmm.
After he was made justice of the peace, he recruited a bunch of prostitutes from St. John's and set up his own brothel. So
Abe learned a lot from him, fictional character.
Yes, yeah. So Abe was very much based on George Ryder.
Yeah.
But part of the reason he appealed to me so much was because he seemed like a carbon copy, or Trump seems like a carbon copy of his type. The big difference between George Ryder and Abe, of course, is that I don't think George Ryder was a coward.
Yeah.
Whereas Abe is.
And Abe isn't the brightest penny in the bundle. It would have to be said. Whereas his sister, who's the adversary in some ways, she is really highly motivated.
The widow is there because this book is a mirror image of the innocents. So I had George Ryder from the start, but I had no story. And I was stuck for quite a while. And then I realized, oh, well, there's got to be a sister. So, and at that point, that's when the story took off. And so the fact that it's a sister means that I had to consider, well, what is the role of women in this situation, in that world? What power do they have? And if they have none, how would they go about getting it? And of course, they would have to be Machiavellian.
Yeah.
Who they are at the beginning is who they are at the end, which presents a challenge for a writer.
Yeah. Everything they do, nothing. There's no moral compass guiding any decision that's made. It's all transactional.
Yes.
It's the art of the deal, to use that phrase. It's all about making the deal that will get them to the place where they can defeat their adversary.
Yeah, and I think that both, as you say, they're chalk and cheese. Like, they're completely different creatures, except in the fact that they are unable to see the outside world as anything other than a piece of them. That it has no independent external existence, and the only thing they're interested in is owning more and more of it. Abe is all appetite. The widow is all will.
Yeah.
So they operate completely differently in the world, but they're equally as bad.
And there's the drama, and there's the tension that holds our collection for the our attention for the novel. I do want to ask you about some of the language within the novel. You do talk a lot about the weather. Hardly surprised in Newfoundland, and suddenly the Irish weather seems perfect by comparison. But some of the turns of phrase, I'm sure there is Irish within that. Irish phrases and other phrases, obviously, from those who came to Newfoundland. You consulted a specific dictionary.
Well, there were a couple of specifics. And one that I've been using my entire life is the Dictionary of Newfoundland English, which is a fantastic work of scholarship. It's about 600 or 700 pages. And it just catalogs the ways that Newfoundlanders over the last 500 years have adapted and added to the English language to suit their circumstances and the place they find themselves. And it's just, as in an oral culture, like people's ability, their creativity and the joy that you find in that language. Like, I think the way that people interact with each other through language in Newfoundland is one of the things that has allowed people to survive difficult circumstances. Like, people are always making each other laugh. That's very essential, I think, to making it work there. But I also realized that these stories are set so far back that most of the characters would actually be Europeans. They would be Irish or English, not Newfoundland.
So it would be a second language for many.
So I went looking
for
another, and I found something called the Dictionary of the Vulgar Tongue. God bless the internet. And it was compiled in 1790-something and updated in 1811. So it's exactly the same as the Dictionary of Newfoundland English, but for the continental English language. Wow. And again, I pillaged. the creativity of that language, people's ability to just tear down each other with language was so great that I spent most of my time just finding ways to get as much of that language into the book as I could. And I feel like the book is very dark. And I think one of the few places of refuge in the book is the language.
Yeah.
It's a place where you can find joy and celebration, you know?
Michael, lovely to speak with you this evening. Congratulations on winning this year's Dublin Literary Award for the novel, The Adversary. And Michael Crummy will appear at the International Literature Festival in Dublin in Merrion Square Park tomorrow evening, Friday the 23rd of May at 6 p.m. for an in-depth conversation about The Adversary with Madeleine Keane. Full information on ilfdublin.com. This year's Cannes Film Festival is in full swing, as you might have gathered from the glitzy and glamorous photos gracing your news feeds. And while the new dress code called for, quote, decency and decorum, unquote, with a move against revealing clothing, many of the films in and out of the competition have stuck to their daring guns. Or should that be daring gunas? Tara Brady joins us live now from the Croisette in Cannes. We'll start with The Irish. A good festival for Element Pictures, two well-received films. But let's begin with Paul Mescal, man of the moment, has been man of the moment for a while now, really, hasn't he? He's there with this his new film, The History of Sound. What can you tell us about The History of Sound and Paul Mescal's role within it, first of all, Tara?
Well, just to say, Paul Mescal looked absolutely fantastic on the red carpet yesterday, and so did Emma Canning, who's another young Irish star who's in the film. Unfortunately, the film itself has not been universally loved, and that's a bit of a theme in Cannes this year. It's a new film from Oliver Hermanis, which is a director I think we both like. I think we're both huge Living fans, and he has adapted this short story by a writer called Ben Shattuck. And it's a queer love story set around the First World War that moves between Kentucky and Boston, a music conservatory in Boston, which is where the two main characters meet. The two main characters are David, played by Josh O'Connor, and then Paul Mescal, who is the main character and who's also narrating the film throughout. And there's obviously been a lot of speculation, and not all of it decent, online in the run-up to this movie, because people were very excited about it, maybe too excited about it. But it is, in fact, a very coy kind of a film. Right. It's a very coy kind of a love story. But mostly it's about the music, and it's about the folk ballads that they enjoy collecting together for a brief period, yeah. just after Josh O'Connor returns from the First World War.
Yeah, and I think what you're saying is the script that's letting it down there rather than the performances, for sure. Element Pictures, great old time this year. They're there with My Father's Shadow and with Pillion, a kinky biker romance starring Alexander Skarsgård.
Indeed it is. This is an absolute hit. Well, I just say My Father's Shadow is also the first Nigerian film to make it in contest. So, you know, that's a really big deal, obviously, for Nigeria. And it's great that Ireland is involved in that production as well. Nigeria has a huge film industry. So it's nice to be in on the ground floor. But Pillion is would be my favorite of the two films, and I think the best way to pitch it is, if you can remember Norman Wisdom, the British, like the slightly goofy 1950s comedian, like he never got around to making a BDSM biker film, but if he did, that this is what it would look like. And it's such a brilliant performance by Harry Melling, who, you know, obviously broke through in the Harry Potter films and has really gone on in the last few years to knock it out of the park, both in terms of the films that he's picked and the roles that he's done, but just a really great actor with just great pathos and great comic timing. And that's really what's needed here, because, you know, he's this sort of slightly sad sack called Colin, whose mum sets him up on his gay dates at the pub. And he, you know, he's part of a barbershop quartet. And then he meets this, like, impossibly handsome, enthralling, sadomasochistic biker, played by Alexander Skarsgård. And so much of it is played for just absolute laugh out loud, riotous comedy. You know, like the mum trying to, you know, wrap, you know, gather up some box of roses and soaps to give to the boyfriend, who obviously wouldn't be seen dead near a box of roses, and the parents trying to invite them down for dinner, and because they strike up this relationship, and Melling is a submissive, and it's really about whether or not he's going to be happy with that forever, or whether he actually wants a little bit of love as
well. Right. Oh, well, that I have to say is sold to the man in the seat to hear in Dublin by the woman on the Croisette in Cannes. Pillion is the title of that film. Very interesting year for actors turned directors. Some interesting names for sure on the red carpet with their directorial debuts. Kirsten Stewart, first of all, much loved in France, of course, but she was there with The Chronology of Water. What did you make of it?
Chronology of Water is one. So one of the there's a couple of really big trends this year. One of them is like films about contagion, AIDS, COVID, and it's very clear. You know, obviously it takes me. So it's very clear that you're. To think about, you know, contagion and plagues, and there's, you know, it's interesting how many movies have touched on AIDS. But the other big trend, big bruising movies about trauma that, you know, come from memoirs, and Lynn Ramsey's one, it has kind of new film Die My Love has Jennifer Lawrence going out of her mind with postpartum psychosis, and Chronology of Water is probably the heaviest going of the lot. It's one of three films by actors. The other is really making a directorial debut. The others are the kind of very light, fluffy Eleanor the Great by Scarlett Johansson, and then Urchin, which is Harris Dickinson's new film, which is absolutely tremendous as well. But Chronology of Water is probably the most impressive because it's not just art house, it's like proper double art house. It's very fragmented. It features a really, really bravado performance by Imogen Poots. She's a survivor of incest and abuse and addiction, who kind of is at one point in the reckoning for an Olympic place for swimming, and everything sort of spirals, and like her life life goes out of control. And it's a tough watch, but it's an incredibly brave choice for Stuart, who has gone all out. It's actually based on a real memoir by Lydia Yuknatovich. And it's to say it's warts and all, there's a lot of blood, there's a lot of secretions, there's a lot of sex. It's a big, heavy movie, and it's one of a lot of big, heavy movies at Cannes this year.
And what about you? You mentioned in passing there Eleanor the Great, and you also mentioned the Harris Dickinson film Urchin. Both of those, are they both kind of on the light, fluffy side of things?
No, Urchin is the closest film I think I've seen to Adam and Paul since and Paul, which is a really, really interesting. It's a really interesting film. It's about a young homeless man, and he's kind of fallen through the cracks, and he ends up. It's played by Frank Delane, who's just absolutely tremendous.
I'll tell you, we're having problems with the line there, Tara. So we'll go to a track just for the time being, and we'll be back with you hopefully in a few minutes' time. There you go. That's a little bit of Silver Dagger, which incidentally Paul Mescal does a version of that song in his particular film that we were talking about, The History of Sound, earlier on. You're back with us, Tara. You were telling me about Urchin, the nearest thing to Adam and Paul since Adam and Paul.
So this is Harris Dickinson, very, very impressive actor. And it's one of those films that is made by an actor where you can see he's actually been watching all the great directors we've worked with. So there's a little bit of like the same kind of use of music that you got in Baby Girl, which was out earlier last year. And you can see he's really thought about his collaborators. It's about a young man who in the opening scenes, he's homeless. He ends up kind of assaulting someone and going to jail, and then he comes back out again. And it's just this kind of, you know, the cyclical way you can fall straight back through the cracks. But it's done in a very, it's done in a way that gives him dignity. It's done in a way that also allows him to have fun sometimes. And so it really does hark back to that Adam and Paul model, but with kind of certain kind of fantasy inserts that recall Trainspotting. So a really strong debut from Harris Dickinson.
Mariska Hargitay is there with a fascinating documentary about her family and, of course, her mother, Jane Mansfield. Biggest bombshells from My Mom Jane. I saw a headline in an article today. Is she telling it, dirt and all, or is she clarifying matters that have been misrepresented, how her mother has been misrepresented?
Well, I don't know about you, but the first thing I ever heard about Jane Mansfield was that she was decapitated in a car crash, which is not true. And so there's a lot of mythology around Jane Mansfield that needs to be discerned. And, you know, and one of the things is that this idea that she's kind of a dumb blonde. And it's really interesting because you see people that she worked with over the years, like Groucho Marx, who knows she's not. Then there's footage of Groucho Marx, and he knows she's not a dumb blonde. He knows that it's an act, in the same way that Monroe did the same kind of act. And like, you know, this is someone who could play piano, who could play violin, who was incredibly talented, and who had really good dramatic timing, but who never really got the roles, because it's that problem of if your cast is kind of a sexy dumb blonde, it's very hard to get out of that box. But the Hargitay film is extremely interesting and really moving, and she was there herself with her family, and it was a kind of lovely moment. It's like when during the applause she just called everyone like, come here to me, and told another story about her mom and her piano, and the piano had been owned by Engelbert Humperdinck. But it is full of revelations and some really, really extraordinary things. And the kind of biggest one is that her dad wasn't really her dad, and this is the cat's secret in the family for the last 20 years. The really, really kind of weird details, like eerie details, like she almost was left behind. She was in the car crash that killed her mother. She was 3 years old at the time. She was thrown under the passenger seat. And just by some miracle, one of her brothers, who was also in the car crash, woke up before he went to the hospital, got to the hospital and said, "Where's my sister?" Otherwise, she would have been left behind in the truck and towed away. And we would have been left without this CSI legend from TV.
Absolutely. You mentioned Jennifer Lawrence and Lynn Ramsey's Die My Love, and we should say, of course, Enda Walsh worked on the script with that, and Seamus McGarvey's cinematography, Irish eyes and ears run over it for sure. But to finish up, Spike Lee's new film, Highest to Lowest, Mr. Denzel Washington starring in this one. What did you make of it, Tara?
It's not as good as the original. There's an awful lot of things that Spike Lee has put in, a lot of Spike Lee things. So you have all the kind of basketball stuff that he likes, and all the artworks that he likes, and all the music that he likes. But it kind of rattles along, and it's a good action film. Denzel Washington plays this music mogul whose son is kidnapped, but then it turns out his son hasn't been kidnapped. It's his chauffeur's son who has been kidnapped, and he has to choose whether or not to pay the ransom for the chauffeur's son. And then it becomes this kind of cat and mouse hunt with A$AP Rocky, the rapper. And there's a lot of stuff going on here. There's a lot of action sequences, but I think the best scenes are between Denzel and A$AP Rocky. And Denzel, who's 70 and he's talking about retiring soon, can still hold his own against one of the toughest rappers around. Even when they're rapping, they do have a rap battle.
And I would guess Denzel gives him a good run for his money. And no matter what,
run for his money.
Yeah, no matter what the script is, it would seem that Denzel Washington can deliver. And you're saying he has delivered here, whatever reservations you have about other aspects of the film. You have much left? Anything left to see that you're excited about in 10 seconds, if you could, Tara?
There's been so much to see. It's been a polarizing festival, and I know that polarizing festival usually means, oh, it's crap. But actually, there's just been an awful lot of titles that everybody hates, or half of the people hate, or half of the people love. Half of the people hated the Lynn Ramsey. Lots of people love Sentimental Values. You watching Trier film last night? I didn't. But it's Romeria, I love that, but not everyone did. So yeah, there's a lot of fighting going on in Cannes this year. But it is the best dress. Everyone is saying it's the best year for dresses ever.
Best dress so festival. Okay, there you go. Thanks for being with us. That's Tara Brady live from the Cannes Film Festival. That's our lot for this Thursday evening. Liam Mullum was on sound this evening. Aina Thacker was the broadcast coordinator. Liam Murphy researched, and tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.